little Johnny's mother raced into the bedroom when she heard him scream and found his toddler sister yanking hard on his hair. She carefully unraveled the little girl's grasp and said to Johnny, "It's okay, sweetheart. She didn't really mean it. She doesn't understand that it hurts." Almost as soon as she was out of the room, she heard the little girl scream. Rushing back in, she asked, "What's wrong?" "She understands now," said Johnny. Revenge is sweet. Three big bikers pulled into a highway cafe where a truck driver, a small guy, sat at a table quietly eating his lunch. As the three bikers entered, they immediately noticed him, snatched away his food, and started taunting him. The truck driver said nothing. He got up, paid for his food, and left. Disappointed that they hadn't succeeded in provoking the little guy into a fight, one of the bikers remarked to the waitress, "Boy, he wasn't much of a man, was he?" The waitress replied, "I suppose not." And then looking through the windows, she added, "He's not much of a driver either. He just ran over three motorcycles." Revenge is sweet. A different little Johnny was in the garden, swimming in a large pool, and his neighbor peered over the fence. Interested in what the youngster was up to, he politely asked, "What are you doing, Johnny?" "My goldfish died," replied the boy fearfully, without even looking up. "I've just buried him." The neighbor was concerned. "That's an awfully big hole for a goldfish, isn't it?" Johnny patted down the last piece of earth and then replied, "That's because he's inside your dumb cat." Revenge is sweet. Or is it? Here they stood before him, his brothers who had conspired first to kill him and then to sell him into slavery. 25 years or more had passed. It was a distant memory, but certainly not forgotten. After a rough start, Joseph had turned things around and climbed his way to second in command to the Pharaoh, dreaming and interpreting dreams that helped prepare him and the entire Egyptian empire for the famine that befell them. Ironic, because it was a dream that had started it all. This from the 37th chapter of Genesis. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his children because he was the son of his own. Broadway musical. It is a masterpiece of storytelling, revealing the heights and depths of the human experience and taking family dysfunction to a whole new level. It is a story, in the end, about forgiveness. As Frederick Buechner writes, almost as much as it is the story of how Israel was saved from famine and extinction, it is the story of how Joseph was saved as a human being. It is a story about letting the past be the past and moving forward into a future of reconciliation and peace. It stands as a model of ultimate forgiveness. For if Joseph can forgive his brothers for attempted murder and selling him into slavery, what can't we forgive? And how petty must that seem? But I would say the story is about a truth that is even greater still. For this is a story about the character of God. For the past 8 chapters of Genesis, the story has been centered on Jacob and his sons, particularly his youngest son, Joseph. It has been a story about pride and the fall that cometh after, a story about a large, diverse, and complex family, a story about peril and opportunity, a story about overcoming great odds, a story about the crazy coincidences of life, story about truth and their consequences. It is a decidedly human story with too many moving parts to count, too many players to keep track of, and in the end, as with all good stories, it all comes together. But here, in verses 5 through 8, as Joseph speaks to his brothers, the first time in 25 years as their brother, another crucial character is identified. And now, do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are 5 more years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. But it is not you who sent me, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and ruler over all the land of Egypt. It is God who has been at work all along, in the dream and in the pit, on the road with the Ishmaelites and in the prisons, on Jacob's farm and in the courts of the Pharaoh, dancing with Jacob and with Joseph, with Judah and with Simeon, with Potiphar and with Benjamin. And this is a story, perhaps the story, of God's sovereignty. As biblical scholar Celia Brewer Marshall notes, if the rule of God is understood as compulsion, then we miss the point. God's omnipotence is then coercive and tyrannical, while humans are automatons programmed to do God's will as if this were set in stone or hardwired into us. But other models for sovereignty and power are made available to us through the biblical text, and Joseph's speech makes this. God's rule allows for free human agency. The will of God does not force itself on creation. You sold me here is true. God sent me before you is also true. For God's sovereignty is known through God's loving kindness. It does not compel, it invites. The freedom of humans to respond to God's sovereignty is maintained, but their actions have been drawn into God's larger purpose for good. Or, as noted scholar and preacher Walter Brueggemann notes, In Joseph's self-disclosure, we are at the center of a great faith affirmation. Neither the freedom of the creature nor the gracious sovereignty of God is canceled out. They are not in conflict, nor are they to be equated. God's will makes use of all human actions, but is domesticated or limited by no human choice. And so often it all happens without our even noticing. In Joseph's world, which feels so much like our own, dramatic religious elements are absent. Throughout the Joseph story, God is barely even mentioned. It is a decidedly human story. There is no call of God, no discussion with God, no appearance even of God. In this way, our culture resonates with the world of Joseph in Egypt, a profane and secular world where it seems obvious that God no longer addresses us with direct speech and extraordinary promises, where many would claim God is not present at all. But we, as people of faith, we know better. Or at the very least, we choose to trust that what Joseph claims is true. That even though we may not see it, God is at work through it all. This story has not simply been about Jacob and his sons, Joseph and his brothers. This is not simply their story. This is God's story. It was God acting in this family, beginning with the dream, then moving through and past the brothers' gruesome thoughts. God propelled the rise to power, giving Joseph the uncanny knack of interpreting dreams. It was God stirring the heart of Judah to his famous speech. Looking back through the lens of faith, the past is made clear. Joseph is able to see his own story for what it truly is. So it was not you who sent me, but God. And the same can be said for us today. The God of Jacob, Judah, and Joseph is also the God of Jamie and Jackie and Jim. As noted preacher Barbara Brown Taylor writes, contrary to what most of us have been taught, it is not about God's will overriding our own. It is more like a dance, a mysterious dance that takes place between God's freedom and our freedom, between God's will and our own. In this dance, it is not God's job to keep bad things from happening. They do happen. Brothers turn against brothers. People are bought and sold. Famine devastates the land. But through it all, we are reminded, as we are in Romans chapter 8, that we know that all things work together for good to those who love God. So in the end, we can stand shoulder to shoulder with Joseph, his brothers, and all the others who believe and proclaim that God is